Ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
When people suffer trauma in their lives, the results can be devastating. In addition to the physical harm that often accompanies trauma-related events, the emotional scars can be even more long-lasting, affecting a person and their families for years after trauma occurs. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to learn more about a program designed to help people deal with the trauma in their lives, helping them at a time when they're experiencing another stressful activity, and that's looking for a job. Our guest is Dimitri Topitsis, a professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. He's helping to lead a program called Healthy Worker, Healthy Wisconsin. Welcome, Dimitri. Good to have you back on.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Yeah, you were with us earlier this year when you were talking about a large conference that took place in Milwaukee earlier this year, focusing on trauma. And that in itself was important as we took a look at sort of a all-hands-on-deck effort here in Milwaukee to help people understand the tremendous impact that trauma has on lives, both individually and in the community at large. But when I heard about this other program that you're working on, I thought, how fascinating that you're helping people as they try to get a job. So talk about that connection between job hunting and why dealing with trauma at that time is so important.
Certainly. So what we have found is that actually those who are seeking job services and the agencies with whom we are working are serving low-income job seekers. Those seeking job services who hail from low-income communities oftentimes themselves have experienced a great deal of adversity and trauma in their lives. A study that I conducted with a colleague of mine, the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, David Pate, he and I found that low-income job seekers experience rates of trauma exposure that were nearly three times those, the rates of the population at large. And a lot of that has to do with the low-income communities in which they were reared and the low-income communities in which they currently reside. So these are folks that have experienced a good deal of adversity in their lives. And more interestingly, that adversity has in some way, shape, or form oftentimes undermined their ability to attain and then retain sustainable employment. Moreover, their experience of adversity and the effects of that adversity sometimes can undermine their ability to respond effectively or successfully to job services. Add on top of that, as you just suggested, that searching for a job can be a very stressful life experience.
Well, for anybody, whether you've had trauma or not.
Exactly right. And so if I've experienced a good deal of trauma, I have a history of employment problems, and now I'm trying to slay that dragon again, it can be very difficult to ultimately to achieve my goals without some extra supports that we are putting in place by virtue of the Healthy Worker, Healthy Wisconsin program.
So just to be clear, when people who have had a traumatic experience impact their lives that has affected their thinking, their behavior, when they're out in the job force or trying to get into the job force, is the problem a result of that trauma having years ago perhaps knocked them off the rails and not allowed them to finish high school, for example, or to develop good work habits? Or is the trauma affecting their ability to do a good interview or to walk in with a good attitude?
It's a great question. I would say both. I would add a third point, which is certainly that trauma is not the only obstacle to long-term employment and employability amongst low-income adults here in the city of Milwaukee. However, I do think, and our research would suggest, that it contributes to the problem. And so, for instance, as you suggested, trauma we know can link with any number of negative life course outcomes. So as you suggested, it can undermine one's educational attainment, and that can have long-term negative implications for one's work or employment success. Trauma can also undermine one's sense of self, one's sense of emotional stability, such that when I am confronted with stressful life experiences, rather than sort of marshaling a number of internal and potentially external resources in order to overcome that obstacle, I may have limited access or just limited resources, limited accesses to resources and limited resources themselves, internal resources that I can draw on to ultimately meet this challenge and realize my life goals. So for instance, when I'm faced with certain life challenges and high levels of stress, I might not necessarily have the coping skills to manage that stress, overcome it, and then march toward my goals, my goal attainment. That's something that we refer to sometimes as self-dysregulation or self-regulation problems, and it's a hallmark of trauma symptoms or trauma effects.
So let's talk about this program, the Healthy Worker, Healthy Wisconsin initiative that you're involved in. We should tell our listeners it's a partnership through the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. That's a program that connects UW-Milwaukee and Children's Hospital and also the Community Advocates Public Policy Initiative. What exactly happens as part of this program that makes a difference in the lives of those who are traumatized, who are looking for work?
Great. So first, we should note that this is a program that is funded by the Wisconsin Partnership Project, which is housed at the University of Wisconsin's School of Medicine and Public Health. And the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute is the lead agency, and UW-Milwaukee and the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. We provide a supportive function, an evaluative and supportive function, but we've worked very closely with one another, particularly Connor Williams over at the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. And what it is we do is we supplement employment services with what we call trauma screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment services. So or T-ESPERT services for short. The T-ESPERT services comprise about or last about 30 to 60 minutes. It's essentially an interview that we conduct with the agency clients, employment service job seekers, and employment service recipients. And essentially what we are hoping to do is to link the clients to healthcare provision by virtue of referring them to a medical home if they don't have one, and by virtue of referring them to an agency called Covering Wisconsin, who can help provide them with health insurance coverage. So we ensure that they have health coverage and a medical home. And then secondarily, we have a client-centered, motivationally-based conversation about trauma, stress, and mental and behavioral health.
Are your clients surprised when they think they came in to get ready for a job interview or to make the pitch of themselves for a position that somebody's asking them about their mental health or physical well-being?
Yes, great question. To some extent, they are surprised when the offer is made available to them. So no one is required to participate in this interview. It's made available. It's an opportunity for people to actually access health-related services that we argue could support their response to the employment service array that they're ultimately receiving. So initially, they may be surprised when they receive that overture, but ultimately, they select in to this particular program because they recognize that they're facing many life challenges in the present and in the past, which may not necessarily have a direct relationship to work performance, job attainment, et cetera, but certainly could influence their ability to attain and retain jobs.
Are they uncomfortable at first? Do you have to provide some reassurance, or are they wary?
Yeah.
Who's this guy, and why is he asking me? Perhaps some questions that relate back to a trauma that brings back some really bad memories.
It's a great question, and there are many even in my field, the field of social work, clinical social work, et cetera, human services that are that would ask that same question. You know, why would we want to actually probe somebody's experience of adversity, violence, exposure, et cetera, in a workforce development context or an employment service context? It seems like a mismatch. But as mentioned before, we do know that previous exposure to trauma can undermine one's ability to succeed in this context, number one. And number two, oftentimes the way in which trauma undermines job attainment is through health-related issues. So through, for instance, mental health problems like depression and anxiety, behavioral health problems like substance use disorder, and even physical health problems like chronic pain, et cetera. So it's definitely indicated to do that here. But then the question becomes, as you asked, how do you do it in such a way that it is tolerable, that it is even invited and acceptable? And
because sometimes those feelings are locked up deliberately. You know, I want to put that in the past and I want to focus on the future.
Absolutely. So we do this within a structured interview context. So we ask these questions in such a way that, as I mentioned earlier, they're client-centered. Clients know that, or respondents know that they don't have to participate in this. Any question that I ask, they certainly don't have to answer. That's number one. Number two, we don't jump into a conversation about trauma exposure. Instead, what we do is we talk about health insurance coverage, we talk about medical home, and then we talk about current stress. We ask people, what are their current stressors? And you can imagine that they are happy to share the challenges and obstacles that they're facing in their life as they try to reach this sometimes challenging goal of attaining and retaining not just a job, but actually meaningful work. Because these are adults that oftentimes are looking for work that is life-giving, if you will, quite meaningful, quite satisfying. And so they are happy to share the challenges, the stressors in their lives. They will, for instance, identify financial challenges as a common stressor, perhaps relational or family dynamics as a stressor, raising children, particularly as single parents, as a particular stressor, perhaps even health-related issues as a stressor. And we listen intently, we listen therapeutically, and we listen sincerely. Then we transition the conversation into previous stressors. And we use a validated screener that I think you have with you.
And we
ask questions about exposure to previous stressors. And as the literature would suggest, people generally speaking, respondents generally speaking, are not very averse, don't have a hard time in responding to these questions.
As some of the questions I thought I would share with our listeners, asking whether or not a person's been in a really bad car accident or an accident at work or at home. Were you hit or kicked hard enough to be injured as a child? Were you attacked with a gun or a knife or a weapon? Now, for some of our listeners, they may say, well, you know, that doesn't happen to me. That doesn't happen to folks in my family. Right. But these could happen to anybody.
So a few responses. That's absolutely right. Number one, we know that these are issues that are relatively experiences that are relatively widely distributed. Trauma is, in essence, a public health issue. It affects, at the very least, 2/3 of the population, according to the epidemiological studies that I have read, and perhaps more than that. But we also know that trauma tends to be concentrated within low-income communities and families. And so we're working with men and women who have been raised in low-income families and houses as children and who currently oftentimes live in low-income communities. And so the chances that they've been exposed to significant trauma is relatively high. So these are oftentimes not sort of irrelevant issues that we're raising with them. Exposure to car accident, natural disasters, these are sort of common what we call index or type 1 traumas, and house fires, et cetera. And people will say yes or no. The majority of people will acknowledge being exposed to index traumas. But there are, within these questions are also embedded what we refer to as type 2 or complex traumas, oftentimes experiences that recur. So exposure to childhood abuse in some way, shape, or form. Exposure to intimate partner violence. Exposure to community violence, which usually doesn't happen just once, but if I live in a relatively violent community, I'm going to be exposed to that, to those events over multiple periods of time, multiple incidents. And so generally speaking, the vast majority of those that we have interviewed acknowledge exposure to significant type 1 and type 2 trauma. And that, and by the vast majority, I mean over 90%.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Dimitri Topitsis. Dimitri is a professor at UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, and we're talking about a project that he's involved in partnership with the Community Advocates Public Policy Program and Children's Hospital here in Milwaukee, along with the UW-Madison Medical School, focused on trauma, specifically trying to help the folks who are living in disadvantaged neighborhoods deal with the trauma in their lives at the same time that they're looking for work. Is there anything else like this going on in other places of the country, or is this a pilot? Are you trying something new here in Wisconsin?
Yes, that's a great question. This is a pilot. I have seen just a very few published studies that indicate that this is happening elsewhere. In one locale, what they did is they actually, within an employment service context, they referred TANF recipients or public aid recipients to a trauma-informed support group within the agency, so that if somebody was experiencing difficulties as a result of trauma exposure in their life, either in the past, distant past, or recent past, then they would participate or select into this support group in order to enhance their coping skills, if you will, reduce their stress, and maybe even resolve their experience of trauma to some extent just by virtue of talking about it within a supportive community. And what they found is that those individuals, those adults who participated in this support group actually responded better to the employment services than those who did not. They had better not just health or mental health related outcomes, they had better employment and income outcomes over the course of time. So that was quite encouraging and quite similar to the model that we're using. What we do is, after we conduct this interview, during which time we ask about trauma exposure, we also ask about the symptoms that might follow from trauma exposure. And then finally, we ask about coping skills. We ask people, well, how have you coped with all this current trauma and stress, or current stress and previous trauma, in order to, in order to highlight resilience. So people will identify coping strategies that reflect great strength and resilience. Well, I invoke my spiritual practice. I have fellowship with my spiritual community. I exercise. I have a great support network, family and friends. I like to read a lot. I love music. Engage in other forms of art, whether through consumption or creativity. So people have wonderful skills that they oftentimes invoke in order to manage their stress.
If they don't have ways to cope, do you try to give them some pathways to be in a better place?
Yeah, great question. We do not. This is not necessarily an intervention per se. It's an interview. It's an assessment and referral interview. I have not come across anyone of the 100 plus people that we have interviewed. I have not come across anyone who has not identified a positive coping skill. So everyone has resilient mechanisms sort of built within them innately, and they invoke them regularly and they express them with pride. But they also, I will also ask the question, are there any coping skills that you invoke that you would like to change? So people oftentimes will use quote unquote negative coping strategies. I don't use that term, but they'll identify, for instance, drug and alcohol use that they think might be a little bit excessive or more than they would like to see.
Self-medicating. That's right. To deal with the stress.
And that's exactly right.
Just get away from it. Are you surprised at the way humans, especially people living in impoverished neighborhoods who have sometimes 2.5 strikes against them, it seems, are you surprised at the level of resilience that they demonstrate?
That's a great question.
Because I think, you know, if some of these really bad things happen to me or my friends, I would say, boy, how do you get back up after
that? The truth. I guess my answer would be yes and no. So yes, I'm surprised because absolutely, if I were faced with the level of adversity in childhood and adulthood that many of the participants in our work have been faced with, I'm not sure I'd get out of bed. I don't know how people do it. I think in part they've developed their own individual resilience. I think also in part there's a collective resilience that they rely on that is expressed through their families and their communities that I've become quite in awe of over the years. But then at the same time, people are also struggling. So they will share with us the challenges that they're facing, the negative coping skills that they invoke in order to survive from day to day. And what we do then, and you hit the nail on the head, we let people know that these negative coping strategies ultimately are helpful in the immediate term. The sort of self-medication theory, as you were invoking, it does a great job of helping me feel better in the moment. And it doesn't just have to be substance-related issues. It can be other issues that sort of take me away from the activities that I want to be engaging in at the time. Isolation, for instance, becoming angrier more often than I would like to, et cetera. Procrastinating, whatever it might be. It doesn't have to be substance-related. And what we let people know is that unless they're able to address their stress and perhaps even their previous trauma, and sometimes in the context of community or even mental health support, it can be difficult to overcome these negative coping strategies. This is a sort of an intervention or a statement that we derive directly from theory and from empirical literature, and people find that to be, rather than accusatory, they find it to be a really sort of liberating and helpful and inviting statement. And what we do next is we say, if you would like, we would be happy to try to connect you with a counselor type, groups that are taking place in the city that support people's recovery from significant stress and trauma. And the idea there is that type of supplemental service can support people's successful and effective response to their employment services.
So what about employers? If employers see someone walk in who clearly, as they take a look at their resume and maybe look at the gaps that exist and find out why somebody was out of the workforce, or just see someone who has lots of skills but seems a little troubled, a little uncomfortable, and in the conversation they realize that this person is carrying some baggage. Is there anything the employer could do with that knowledge that might help this person?
That's a very insightful question. And people in the workforce development and employment service sector recognize that partnering with the employer is best practice, if you will. If I want to help somebody land a meaningful and long-term employment position, then if I'm an employment service agency, a workforce development professional, then I want to, of course, work closely with the individual, with the client, but I also want to work closely with the employer, the placement at which I will ultimately direct and send my client. And with a number of the agencies with whom we are working, Milwaukee Jobs Work comes to mind, UMOS Inc. comes to mind, Mindful Staffing comes to mind, Center for Self-Sufficiency. These are our employment service partners. Often what they will do is they will work closely with the employer. They'll have a number of different outlets, a number of different employers with whom they place their clients. And they'll let the employer know, okay, these are the strengths of this particular client, and these are some of the challenges that they're facing. And as that client moves through the probationary or transitional period, perhaps you can help them work on enhancing their strengths and minimizing their limitations or their weaknesses. And the employment service agency works in tandem then with the employer and in part with some of the information that we shared with the employment service agency, if in fact the client gives us permission to do that, so that the employer has a fuller picture of who this person is. And we're living in at least in the current economic context, where employment is somewhat plentiful. Employers are looking for employees. So they want employees to succeed. They don't want
to invest a good deal of time and training for a particular employee and then lose that person because they're facing challenges that no one was aware of and we didn't address by virtue of external and perhaps even internal support.
So do you think the great supply of jobs out there has changed the attitude of employers today, giving them a greater incentive or willingness to give these folks a chance who are starting out with those 2.5 strikes?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is yes. I don't have great insight into that particular dynamic because I've only sort of been involved in workforce development and employment services over the course of the last 2 years. My partners at the employment service agencies and at Community Advocates Public Policy Institute could answer that question better. But I believe the answer is a resounding yes. When we're at quote unquote near full employment, then employers are much more willing to work with their employees. They don't have someone waiting in the wings that they don't want to lose the investment that they just made in all this training, perhaps.
But it seems what is a game changer here, what's so valuable, is that people like you are now positioned to help your clients, to help that worker, that would-be worker, open up and begin talking more freely, more honestly about the stressors in their life so that the employer has an idea that this guy's just not a screw up. You know, he's had some things happen in his life or she's had some things happen that are making life difficult.
Absolutely.
It would seem that it would allow them to be, if not more forgiving, more empathetic.
Absolutely. And perhaps help with strategies better. Well, this person does better alone, and these are the positions that would be sort of better suited for this person. Or this person does better at this particular time, so this here's the times when perhaps we can offer more breaks. That said, the onus still rests with the employee to do a good job. And so I'm not suggesting—
They don't get a free pass.
That's right. I'm not suggesting that trauma-informed employment services result in employers relaxing standards. Instead, it does perhaps suggest that employers can enhance their awareness of who their employees are and provide supports within certain parameters that can enhance the probability of success. But it also means primarily that the employee has an enhanced awareness of what their strengths are, what the challenges they generally come with are, and how to address them. Within, but also outside of the formal workplace. So, how do I enhance my positive coping skills? How can I minimize my negative coping skills? How can I address my trauma in such a way that it helps to dissipate the energy and the negativity and the stress that oftentimes accompanies it? These are the kinds. This is the kind of information that we share and exchange with clients, and then we also refer them to mental and behavioral health specialists who can dive more deeply into these issues.
Fascinating, Dimitri. As usual, you're a great person to open the door into our understanding of trauma and how it's affecting individuals and our community at large.
Thank you so much.
Dimitri Topitzis, a professor at UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.